tree off the road, but it was far too large for him to budge. Braden and Nolan ran forward and tried to help. The whole time, Gideon just kept barking.
"Somebody hit that dog and shut it up,"
Mr. Crankshaw shouted, spittle flying from his mouth.
"Mr. Crankshaw, I think we should turn the carriage around and go back the other way,"
Braden said sharply, obviously perturbed by his comment about the dog. Mr. Crankshaw agreed. But at that moment, a loud cracking sound filled the forest air. Serafina crouched, prepared to spring. A great shattering of wood erupted into an explosive crash as a large tree fell across the road behind them. The horses squealed in panic and went up rearing and striking, pulling on their leather harnesses and dragging the carriage across the ground, even though the brake was engaged and the wheels wouldn't turn. Their instinct was to run, whether they were free of the harnesses or not. Braden ran forward to help them.
"No, Braden!" Serafina cried as she reached to stop him.
The boy seemed determined to get himself killed by a horse kick. Braden leapt in front of the horses. He was able to calm them with a few soft words and quickly got them under control. Seeing that he was safe, Serafina scanned the forest in the direction of the fallen tree. That's when she realized that the worst had happened. The carriage, its four horses, the four humans, and the dog were now trapped on a section of road between two trees. Mr. Crankshaw, gripping the axe, stomped to the back of the carriage and shouted furiously into the darkness,
"Who's out there? Show yourselves, you rotten, filthy swine!"
Serafina looked into the darkness, waiting for an answer to come. But Mr. Crankshaw's words drifted out into the black nothingness without reply.
"Mr. Crankshaw," Braden said firmly, "we need to go back to cutting the tree in front of us. The safest course now is to press on to Asheville."
"I just hope we can get there,"
Mr. Crankshaw carped beneath his breath, stomping back. As Mr. Crankshaw, Braden, and Nolan worked on the tree, Serafina couldn't help but look behind the carriage where the most recent tree had fallen. Gideon was looking in that direction as well, his eyes black in the starlight.
"What do you think, boy?"
she whispered as she crouched beside him and peered into the darkness.
"Is there something out there?"
She and the dog were on the same side now. She wondered about the second fallen tree. It couldn't be a coincidence. Someone was deliberately blocking them in so that they could not escape. She scanned the forest. She had good senses, but she knew she couldn't smell nearly as well as Gideon, and he seemed to smell something right now. He wasn't barking anymore, but was staring intently into the forest, waiting for something to appear. For all his faults as a dog, he was a brave defender. But she hated this, the looking, the waiting, feeling like a trap was slowly surrounding them. She couldn't stand it. She didn't know how to defend. She knew how to hunt. And right now, it felt like they were the ones being hunted, and she didn't like the feeling one bit. She took a few steps forward into the trees to see how it felt. Her skin crawled with equal parts fear and excitement. She was drawn into the forest. Her instinct was telling her to go deeper. She took a few more steps. Gideon looked at her and tilted his head as if to say,
"Are you crazy? You can't go in there."
But then she padded quietly into the trees and ducked into the underbrush. She wanted to move, to prowl, to see what was out there, whatever it was. She wanted to be the hunter
not the hunted.
Leaving Gideon to guard the carriage, she crept deeper and deeper into the darkness of the forest. The very same black forest that her father had told her never to enter. The very same dark forest that Crankshod had said was filled with ghosts and demons. But she was calm. She was in the right place. She figured if her mother could move through the forest at night, then so could she. Suddenly, she heard the sounds of footfalls in the brush in front of her, as clear as a rat's footsteps in the basement, but much louder, much larger, moving through the leaves and the dirt. She wasn't sure whether it was an animal or a human. As she crept closer to the sound, she crouched down but kept moving slowly forward. Sound and sight and feeling and smell, her whole body felt alive with sensation. With all her senses working, all her muscles in play, she stalked so slowly, so quietly, that she didn't make a single sound. She heard the footsteps ahead of her more closely now, feet crunching through autumn leaves, walking at first, and then breaking into a run. A man running through the underbrush, some 50 yards out into the woods. She ran toward the sound, knowing that when a rat was moving, it couldn't hear nearly as well as when it wasn't. When the man suddenly stopped, she stopped as well and remained perfectly still, holding her breath. She knew the man must be listening for her, but she made no sound. As soon as he started moving again, she moved as well, shadowing him. But then something happened. The footsteps stopped. She felt a swooshing sensation of air on her face and head, like the beat of a vulture's wing. And then suddenly she heard a second set of footsteps behind her, between her and the carriage. How was that possible? Were there multiple attackers? The forest erupted in a cacophony of sound. Leaves crashing, sticks breaking, the rush of rapid movement. Her muscles exploded to life. It was an attack coming in from all directions. In the distance, Gideon started barking and snarling and gnashing his teeth as if he were facing down Satan himself. The carriage, she thought. They're attacking the carriage. She turned and sprinted toward it, heedless of the sound she made. She glimpsed a flash of movement surge past her in the darkness, but could not tell what it was. As she ran toward the carriage, she could see Braden and Nolan. But where was Crankshod? He was the strongest person in their group, the man who was supposed to be protecting them. "Look out, Braden!" she shouted in warning. "They're coming! Look out!" Hearing her call, Braden turned just in time to dodge the flashing shape of the incoming attacker. But then, in a startling movement of whirling black shadow, the attacker turned and was upon him again. Gideon charged in, snarling and biting. Nolan punched and kicked. Fighting, shouting, striking, all was confusion in a swirl of motion and battle. Just as Serafina came within striking distance, a large black shape floated past her. She flinched so hard that her back hit a tree. Giant centipedes poured out of logs, worms oozed up out of the earth. The man in the black cloak had come. He was here in these woods. There weren't multiple attackers. There was only one. He seemed to float on the violence of the battle, his decaying, blood-dripping hands reaching outward as he came upon Braden. It was clear he wanted the boy in particular. Serafina leapt forward to defend her friend.
Gideon charged as well, but it was little Nolan, in a desperate act of shouting courage, who threw himself in front of the young master and blocked the attack. The man in the black cloak opened his arms and pulled Nolan to his chest. The slithering folds of the cloak wrapped around the boy. Nolan's shouts turned to screams. The gray smoke filled the forest. The rattling shook the trees. And then Nolan disappeared. It took her breath away to see it again. "No!" she cried out in anguish, anger, and frustration. Then the shaking came, and the glowing, and the terrible stench that followed. Every leaf on every tree around them suddenly fell to the ground, drenched with blood, and the ground itself became a stinking, horrific mud. Expanded in size and now seemingly more powerful than ever, the man in the black cloak advanced, heading straight for Brayden once more. Brayden needed to fight or flee, but he stood frozen in shock by what he'd just seen happen to Nolan. He stared at the man in the black cloak, unable to move. Without thinking, Serafina charged forward and pounced on the man's back. She caterwauled a wild and crazed screech of anger. Her hands and feet clawed at the man with snarling ferocity. The man in the black cloak had no choice but to turn and fight her. He tried to pull her off his back and wrap her in his voluminous black cloak like he had the others, but Brayden pulled back a mighty swing and slammed the man's head with a large branch. Gideon lunged forward and bit the attacker repeatedly. Serafina tore herself free, rolled to the ground, spun, and leapt back into the battle. All three of them pressed the attack. The man in the black cloak, his eyes still glowing with power, levitated upward. Three against one now, he had lost the element of surprise. He snapped the billowing folds of the black cloak with his arm, and a great explosion of air knocked Serafina off her feet. She went tumbling backward as the man in the black cloak withdrew into the forest and then was gone. Gasping to catch her breath, Serafina scrambled to her feet and readied herself for the next attack. But it never came. The battle was over. She looked at her hands. Her fingers were slippery with blood, and her fingernails had torn at the man in the black cloak's rotting skin. But it was more than just the remnants of the battle. It was like the skin in the glove. He was disintegrating. Through the darkness, she saw Brayden lying on the ground. Frightened that he'd been wounded, she ran over to him. "Are you hurt?" she sputtered.
"I'm all right,"
he gasped as she helped him onto his feet.
"What about you? Did he hurt you?"
"I'm all right," she said.
I don't understand, Serafina. What was that thing? What happened to Nolan?"
"I don't know," she said, shaking her head in frustration.
"I mean, where did he go? Is he dead?"
She didn't know the answer to Brayden's questions. Thinking about poor little Nolan made her sick to her stomach, angry, frightened. He was just gone. How could she help him? It was the second time she'd battled the man in the black cloak, and the second time she'd lost a friend. "Come on, we gotta go before it comes back," she said, touching his shoulder.
"What happened to Crankshod?" Brayden asked as he and Gideon followed her back toward the carriage and horses.
"I never saw him," she answered.
"Do you think it got him, too?"
She could hear the fear and confusion in his voice. "No. There's a rattling noise when it does it. And there was only one rattle."
"You know what it is," he said,
grabbing her arm and bringing her to a stop.
"Tell me, Serafina."
"I saw it last night," she said. "It took Clara Brahms the same way."
"What?" What do you mean? Where? Does this mean that Clara's dead? I don't understand what's going on.
Neither do I, she said. But we've got to go.
Brayden picked up a stick from the ground and looked out into the forest.
Whatever it is, it's still out there.
She knew he was right. They had fought it off, but it was definitely still out there. She couldn't forget the image of Nolan leaping forward to save his master. She could still see the terror-stricken look on the boy's face right before he disappeared. As she looked at Brayden, she couldn't help the terrible sinking feeling that crept into her mind.
Whatever it is, she said, it didn't come for Nolan. It came for you.
Chapter 8.
The axe is gone, Serafina said as she and Brayden searched the area around the carriage.
Without the axe or anyone to help them move the trees, they couldn't clear the road in front of them or behind them. They were trapped.
We can ride the horses, Brayden suggested.
But the trees grew so closely together in this part of the forest that the horses couldn't pass between them, which was almost a relief to Serafina, because she couldn't imagine clawing her way up onto the back of one of those stompers and expecting it not to kill her.
We can walk, she said.
11 miles is a long way to walk in these woods, he said, especially at night.
He kept looking around, obviously frustrated, and she was too. But there was something she liked about the fact that they were in this together. He was thinking of her as an ally. She'd never spent much time with other people, but she was beginning to see why people liked it, although she was pretty sure that not everyone was as clever and kind as Brayden Vanderbilt.
If we stay here, we can use the carriage for shelter, he said. My uncle sent a rider ahead to tell the Vances that I was on my way. When I don't arrive, they'll come looking for me. I'm sure of it. I think we should wait for help.
She didn't want to agree. She wanted to keep moving. But she knew he was probably right. She kept hearing the words he'd said to the horses.
We're in this together. We're going to be all right.
The words felt strangely reassuring to her as well. She watched as Brayden unharnessed the horses for the night. The horses couldn't go far because of the fallen trees blocking the road, but at least they could move around. He gave them hay and water from the supply that Nolan had stowed in the back of the carriage. Prior to this, she had only seen horses from a distance, and they had always seemed like terribly wild and unpredictable beasts. But as she watched Brayden working with them, talking to them and caring for them, they seemed to be such good-hearted creatures, far more intelligent than she realized.
Horses usually sleep standing up, Brayden said, and they always take shifts so that at least one of them is awake and alert for danger. If they sense something, they'll raise the alarm. You just have to know the signals.
Excellent. We have watch horses, she said with a smile, trying to cheer him up.
Brayden smiled in return, but she could see he was still very frightened by what had happened, and she was too. When a gust of wind passed through the trees, she reflexively spun around, fearful that the flying specter had returned.
What do you see?
Brayden asked.
Nothing, she said. It's just the wind.
The night's cold had settled onto the forest, and with the moonlight that filtered down through the trees, they could see their breath. When a screech owl gave an eerie trill in the distance, it startled Brayden. But the sound of the bird calmed Serafina. She had lived all her life hearing those sorts of sounds on her nightly prowls of Biltmore's grounds.
Just an owl,
Braden said as he exhaled.
Just an owl, she agreed.
As they climbed into the carriage, Braden held the door open for her and helped her up the little steps, touching her back with his hand. It was as if they were entering the grand ballroom for the holiday dance. As a young gentleman, it was a natural gesture for him, probably just a habit, but it was a sensation she had never felt before. For a moment, that gentle touch of Braden's hand against her back was all she could feel or think about. It was the first time in her life that anyone other than her pa had touched her in a kind and gentle way. She tried hard to tell herself that Braden's touch probably meant a lot more to her than it did to him. He probably wasn't even aware that he'd touched her. She knew that he had danced and dined with many fancy-dressed girls. It was probably silly for her to think that he wanted to be friends with a girl who wore a shirt for a dress and couldn't ride a horse.
Come on,
Braden said quietly to Gideon, and the dog hopped up into the carriage with them. Braden shut and locked the wooden door and shook it a few times to make sure that it was secure. Gideon circled twice, then took his position on the floor guarding the door.
I'm sorry there aren't any blankets,
Braden said, looking through the carriage's storage cabinets and trying to figure out how they were going to stay warm.
Not even a good cloak to sleep under.
I'll pass on the cloak, thank you, Serafina said with a smile,
and Braden laughed a little. But he seemed almost as nervous as she was to be crammed inside the carriage together, with nothing to do but look at each other in the darkness. Braden sat down and patted the seat beside him.
Perhaps you should sit here, Serafina, on this side. We've got to stay warm somehow.
Despite the uncomfortable tightness forming in her chest, she slowly moved toward him. She hoped she didn't smell like the basement. If he was accustomed to ladies like Anastasia Rostanova, with her lavish dresses, or even Miss Whitney with her rose-scented perfume, she couldn't imagine that her own scent would be too pleasant for him.
"Excuse me, Miss Serafina," he would say, gagging and coughing. "On second thought, perhaps you should indeed sleep on the floor with the dog."
But he didn't say that. She sat beside him, and the world didn't come to an end. As they snuggled together a little to stay warm, she fretted that he'd discover some bizarre characteristic about her that she didn't even realize was bizarre. She just hoped there wouldn't be a reason for her to take off her shoes in Braden's presence and have him notice her missing toes. She didn't want him to get too close. Would he be able to feel her missing bones? She wasn't even sure which ones they were. How many bones did a person usually have, anyway? She had always been content to snuggle into small places on her own, but she was surprised to find herself so comfortable cuddled up beside him. She was able to relax a little and breathe again. Earlier that morning, when she'd woken up wedged in a metal drying rack in Biltmore's basement, the last place in the world she would have thought she'd spend her next evening was nestled in the velvet warmth between the Vanderbilt boy and his valiant guard dog. Gideon, for his part, seemed to have gotten over his initial reaction to her. They'd fought together on the same side, she and this dog. And maybe they were a little bit friends now, at least temporarily.
Serafina, I need to ask you a question,
Braden said in the darkness.
All right, she agreed, but she knew it wasn't going to be good.
Why do you live in the basement?
She didn't know if he considered her to be his friend, or if they were just shoved together by happenstance and he was making the best out of a bad situation. But after all they'd been through together, it didn't seem right to lie to him. And she didn't want to.
I'm the machine mechanic's daughter, she said finally. She just said it, just like that, out loud. Even as she said the words, she felt both pride and a sickening feeling of impending doom that she had betrayed her father.
I've always liked him, Braden said casually. He fixed the buckle on my saddle and made it much more comfortable for my horse.
He likes you too, she said, although she remembered that her pa had spoken more about the buckle than the boy that day.
So have you been down there in the basement all this time?
Braden asked in amazement. I'm good at staying out of the way, she said simply. She wanted to tell him that she was the chief rat catcher, but she held her tongue, not sure how he would react to the thought of her grabbing rats. He might want to know when she had last washed her hands. She suddenly doubted if he even cared what she did. All sorts of rich and famous people and their children came to Biltmore, so why would Braden care what she did all night?
So you were down there in the basement when you saw the man in the black cloak the first time? He said. Who do you think it is?
I don't know, she said. I don't even know if he's a human or a haint.
What's a haint?
Braden asked, his eyebrows raised. A shade. A haunt. You know, a ghost. The man in the black cloak may be some sort of wraith that comes out of the woods at night. But I think he's a mortal man. I think he's one of the gentlemen at Biltmore.
What makes you think that?
Braden said in surprise. His satin cloak, his shoes, the way he walks, the way he talks. There's something about him, like he thinks he's better than everyone else.
Well, he's certainly scarier than anyone I've met,
Braden said, but then said no more. She could tell that her theory that the man in the black cloak was a gentleman at Biltmore had disturbed him. They sat in silence for a long time. She could feel Braden's warmth beside her, his breathing, and the beating of his heart. She could smell the faint scent of wool, leather, and horses on him. Regardless of what the two of them being in the carriage together might or might not really mean, for the moment, it brought her a wonderful sense of peace, a sense that she belonged, and that despite everything that was going on, she was exactly where she was meant to be. It didn't make any sense to her, or even seem possible, but there was no denying that that was how she felt. I need to ask you to do me a favor, she said quietly.
All right, he said.
Please don't tell anyone about me and my father. He really needs his job. He loves Biltmore.
Braden nodded his head. I understand. I won't tell anyone, I swear.
Thank you, she said, relieved. It felt like she could trust Braden, and his reputation among the kitchen staff for being a loner who preferred to spend time with his animal friends rather than human beings seemed totally unfair to her now. As Braden fell asleep, his breathing became slow and steady. Remaining very still, Serafina turned to gaze upon him. She passed her eyes over his smooth, pale complexion. He was so clean, and his clothing fit so well. His woolen jacket must have been made just for him. Even the buttons had been wrought with his very own initials, B.V., etched upon every one. Mr. and Mrs. Vanderbilt must have commissioned those buttons, she thought. Did that mean they loved and cherished Braden? Or was it just so that he would fit into their elegant society? Her pa had told her the story of Mr. Vanderbilt while they were washing up after supper one night in the workshop. Like many well-off gentlemen in society, George Vanderbilt used his inheritance to build a home. But he didn't build it in New York City like all the others. He built it in the remote wilds of western North Carolina, set deep in the densely forested mountains, miles and miles from the nearest town. The ladies and gentlemen of elite New York society thought this was extremely eccentric behavior. Why would such a highly educated man, born and raised in the civilized luxury of New York City, want to live in the wilderness of such a dark and forested place? Biltmore Estate took years to build, but when it was finally finished and everyone saw what George Vanderbilt had done, they understood his dream. He had constructed the largest, most magnificent home in America, surrounded by a working, self-sustaining estate and the gentle beauty of the Blue Ridge Mountains. He married a few years later, and everyone who was fortunate enough to earn an invitation came to the city of Asheville to visit George and Edith Vanderbilt. They were the rich, the famous, and the powerful. Senators, governors, great industrialists, leaders of foreign countries, favored musicians, talented writers, artists, and intellectuals of all kinds. And it was beneath this glittering world that her pa had raised her. She looked at Braden, and she remembered when he came to Biltmore 2 years before. The servants spoke of the tragedy in hushed tones. Mr. Vanderbilt's 10-year-old nephew was coming to live at Biltmore because his family had died in a house fire in New York. No one knew how it started. Perhaps an oil lamp or a spark from the cook fire in the kitchen. But the house caught on fire in the middle of the night. Gideon woke Braden in a smoke-filled bedroom, pulled at his arm with his teeth, and dragged him from his bed. With the walls and ceiling ablaze around them, they stumbled out of the burning house, choking and exhausted. They barely escaped with their lives. Gideon had saved him. It was only then that Braden discovered that his mother, father, brothers, and sisters were all dead. His entire family had been consumed by the fire. It made Serafina shudder to think about it. She couldn't stand the thought of losing her pa. How sad and lost Braden must have felt to lose his whole family. She had heard the servants talk about how hundreds of ladies and gentlemen, servants and folk of every ilk came out for the funeral. 4 black horses pulled the black carriage stacked with 8 coffins. As a little boy walked alongside, holding his uncle's hand. She remembered watching the boy the day he arrived at Biltmore and wondering about him. The servant said he came with no luggage, no belongings whatsoever, other than the 4 black horses, which his uncle agreed to ship by train from New York. Moving closer to Braden, she remembered what he'd said to her earlier that night.
"These horses and I have been friends for a long time."
From that day forward, she had kept a lookout for the boy. She often saw him walking the grounds in the morning. He spent long periods of time watching birds in the trees. He fished for trout in the streams, but much to the consternation of the cook, he always released whatever he caught. When she watched him in the house, he didn't seem comfortable around boys and girls his own age, or most of the adults either. He loved his dog and his horses, but that was all. Those seemed to be his only friends. She remembered overhearing his aunt speaking to a guest once. "He's just going through a phase," Mrs. Vanderbilt had said, trying to explain why he was so quiet at the dining table and so shy at parties. "He'll snap out of it." But Serafina had a feeling that he never did. His aunt and uncle lived in a world of extravagant parties. But from a distance, Braden seemed to find more accomplishment in riding a horse
or repairing the wing of a wounded hawk than dancing with the girls at the resplendent proms. She remembered prowling around outside the windows of the winter garden when it was all lit up for a ball one summer's eve. She watched the girls in their lovely gowns sashaying this way and that, dancing with the boys, and drinking sparkling punch from a giant fountain in the center of the room. She'd always wanted to be one of those girls in a fancy dress and shiny shoes. She remembered listening to the orchestra play and the people talking and laughing. Crouched down in the shadow beneath the windows, she could look over and see the silent gaze of the stone lions guarding the front doors of the house. She didn't know how Braden felt about her, but there was one thing for sure. She was different. Different from any girl he had seen before. She had no idea whether that fixed her as friend or enemy, but it was something. It was the middle of the night now, and she knew that she should sleep, but she wasn't tired. The day hadn't left her exhausted. It had exhilarated her. Suddenly, the entire world was different than it had been the day before. She'd never felt so alive in her life. There were so many questions, so many mysteries to solve. She kept praying that somehow, some way, despite everything she had seen, Clara, Nolan, and Anastasia were still alive, and she could save them. She wanted to go outside and hunt through the woods in search of clues about the man in the black cloak. But she decided to stay where she was, content to remain curled up beside Braden. After a while, it began to rain a heavy rain, and she listened to the sound of it on the leaves of the trees and the roof of the carriage, and she thought it was a perfect sound. Her eyes and ears open, she vowed that if the man in the black cloak came again that night, she'd be ready. Chapter 9 When Serafina awoke the next morning, the gentle rays of the rising sun filtered through the carriage window, bathing her and Braden in a soft golden light. Braden slept soundly beside her. Gideon lay at their feet, quiet and restful. Suddenly, the dog raised his head and perked his ears. Then she heard the sound as well. Trotting horses, turning wheels, the rattle of approaching carriages. She sprang up. She didn't know whether the carriages were bringing friends or enemies, but either way she didn't want to be seen. If she stayed in the carriage, she was trapped. She needed space to watch, to move, to fight. She hated to leave him, but she touched Braden on the shoulder. "Wake up! Someone's here!" Then she slipped out of the carriage and darted into the forest before he had even awoken. Hiding in the bushes and trees, some distance into the undergrowth, she watched Braden and Gideon exit the carriage. Braden rubbed his eyes in the sunlight and looked around for her, obviously wondering where she'd disappeared to.
"Over here! I found the carriage!"
a man shouted as he climbed through the branches of the tree that had fallen across the road. Several carriages and a dozen men on horseback had come from Biltmore in search of Braden. As the gang of men went to work with great two-man saws and lumber axes to hack away the tree, Mr. Vanderbilt climbed his way through the branches, crossed over the fallen trunk, and hurried toward Braden.
"Thank God you're safe," he said, his voice filled with emotion as they embraced.
Braden was obviously glad and relieved to see his uncle.
"Thank you for coming for me."
As they separated, Braden pressed back his sleep-ruffled hair with his hands and scanned the trees. Then he looked toward the carriages and rescuers. She knew he was looking for her, but she had hidden herself like a creature in the woods.
She felt like a wild animal there, beneath the leaves of the rhododendrons and the mountain laurel. The forest wasn't something she feared, like she had the night before. It was her concealment, her protector.
"Tell me what happened, Braden,"
Mr. Vanderbilt said, seeming to sense Braden's anxiety.
"We were attacked in the night," Braden said,
his voice ragged and his face splotchy with emotion.
"Nolan was taken. He's gone. Mr. Crankshaw disappeared right when the battle started and hasn't shown up since."
Mr. Vanderbilt frowned in confusion. He put his hand on Braden's shoulder and turned him toward the gang of workers cutting through the tree and clearing the road. In addition to the servants, Serafina recognized a dozen other men from the house, including Mr. Bendel, Mr. Thorne, and Mr. Brahms. She let out a small gasp. There was Mr. Crankshaw, working among them.
"Mr. Crankshaw said a group of bandits attacked," Mr. Vanderbilt said. "He fended them off, but when he attempted to pursue them, he became separated from the carriage and decided it was best to head back to Biltmore as fast as possible to fetch help. I was furious he'd left you, but in the end, he was the one who led us here to you. So maybe he was right to do what he did."
Serafina saw Braden look at Mr. Crankshaw in surprise. The ugly man looked right back at him, his eyes betraying nothing.
"I'm not sure it was bandits, Uncle,"
Braden said uncertainly.
"I only saw one attacker, a man in a black cloak. He took Nolan. I've never seen anything like it. Nolan just vanished."
"We'll send a mounted search party up and down this road until we find the boy,"
Mr. Vanderbilt said.
"But in the meantime, I want to get you back to the house."
As Braden and Mr. Vanderbilt spoke, Serafina watched Mr. Crankshaw. She wondered what the old rat was up to. Something wasn't right with him. He hadn't fought any bandits. He had simply disappeared. And now here he was again, with a crooked tale of his own heroism. The only good news was that it seemed like he hadn't spilled the grits about her existence to Mr. Vanderbilt. Was Crankshaw a hero? A villain? Or was he nothing more than a common rat-faced coward? She looked around at Mr. Vanderbilt, Mr. Crankshaw, and the other men. She was beginning to see how difficult it was to determine who was good and who was bad, who she could trust and who she had to watch out for. Every person was a hero in his own mind, fighting for what he thought was right, or just fighting to survive another day. But no one thought they were evil. Gideon wasn't so forgiving. He charged toward Mr. Crankshaw right away and started barking and snarling at him.
Maybe dogs really can smell fear, Serafina thought, or at least cowardliness.
It didn't look like Gideon was actually going to bite Mr. Crankshaw, but he wasn't going to let him off without a good barking to. The other men watched in amusement. But Mr. Crankshaw was none too pleased by the dog's attention.
"Ah, shut up, you stupid mutt!"
Mr. Crankshaw shouted and raised his arms to strike the dog with his axe. Braden and Serafina were too far away to help, but Mr. Thorne clamped his hand onto Mr. Crankshaw's arm and stopped him mid-blow.
"Don't be a fool, Crankshaw." "Ah, what the—" "Just keep that mangy cur away from me,"
Mr. Crankshaw grumbled and stomped away. Braden ran over to Gideon and Mr. Thorne.
"Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you so much."
"It's good to see you're all right, young Master Vanderbilt,"
Mr. Thorne said cheerfully, patting Braden's shoulder with his leather-gloved hand.
"Sounds like you'll have some big stories to tell everyone at dinner tonight about your adventure through the forest."
Did you see anyone else when you arrived?
Braden asked him, still holding Gideon but looking around again for Serafina.
Not to worry, Mr. Thorne said. Those yellow-bellied sorts aren't the type of men to stick around after an attack. I'm sure they're long gone by now.
Despite his reassuring words, Serafina noticed that he was wearing an elegant dagger on his belt and wondered if he had half expected to encounter the bandits himself.
I'm sure you're right, Mr. Thorne, Mr. Vanderbilt said, shaking his head angrily as he walked up to them. But it's hard to believe that bandits would venture such a brazen attack so close to Biltmore. I'm going to ask the police to increase their patrols of the road.
Braden didn't seem to be listening to much of any of this. He just kept looking out into the trees. Serafina wanted to let him know she was all right, but she couldn't let those men see her, and she definitely didn't want to have to explain who she was or why she had been in the carriage with Braden. So she stayed quiet and out of sight. Braden squatted down and put his hands on Gideon, who was looking out into the trees in her direction.
Can you smell her, boy? He whispered.
What are you doing?
Mr. Vanderbilt asked gruffly. Braden stood, knowing that he'd been caught out.
Who are you looking for, Braden? Mr. Vanderbilt asked him.
Serafina sucked in her breath. That was the question she had been dreading. Who was Braden looking for? This is where her and her pa's secret would come out. Braden's answer to his uncle's question had the power to destroy her life. When Braden hesitated, Mr. Vanderbilt frowned.
What do you have to say, Braden? Spit it out.
Braden didn't want to lie to his uncle, but he shook his head and looked at the ground.
Nothing, he said.
Serafina breathed a sigh of relief. He'd kept his promise. He wasn't going to tell.
Thank you, Braden. Thank you, she thought.
But then his uncle lit into him.
You've got to buck up, son, Mr. Vanderbilt said. You're 12 years old now, and that's plenty old enough to handle yourself properly. Don't be scared of what's going on here. You've got to take charge of yourself. Be a man. We're only dealing with bandits here. Thieves.
I don't think it was bandits, Braden said again.
Of course it was. This is nothing a Vanderbilt can't handle. Do you agree?
Yes, sir,
Braden said glumly, looking at the ground.
Just hungry, I guess.
Mr. Thorne stepped in to rescue him.
Well, then, by all means, let's get some food in you, he said enthusiastically, putting his arm around Braden. Come on, I raided the kitchen on my way out. I brought a sack full of pulled pork sandwiches, and if that doesn't suit, we'll dig right into the raspberry spoon bread.
Braden glanced once more into the forest, then turned and followed Mr. Thorne. Serafina desperately wanted to give poor Braden some clue that she was out there and that she was safe. If she had been any other kind of girl, she would have left some sort of token for him when she left, a signal of their connection, perhaps a silver locket, a lace handkerchief, or a charm from her bracelet. But she was a wild girl and didn't have any of those possessions to give. As the men gathered around Braden, happy and relieved that they'd found him, Serafina noticed Mr. Rostanov, the bearded and portly Russian ambassador, step away from the others and stand alone at the edge of the road. Braden had told her that Mr. Rostanov didn't know English too well. The poor man gazed tearfully into the forest, as if wondering whether his dear Anastasia had been murdered by what lurked in its shadows. He took out a handkerchief, wiped his eyes, and blew his nose. Braden had said that Mr. Rostanov and his daughter were only scheduled to stay at Biltmore Estate for a few days before they returned home to their family in Russia in time for Christmas. But when Anastasia disappeared, he had stayed on, continuing the search for her. Mr. Rostanov couldn't bear the thought of returning home to his wife without his daughter. Back over by the carriages, some of the men went over to Mr. Crankshod, who was still put out by the incident with the dog, and thanked him for leading the search party to Braden. But there was something about Crankshod, all smiling and greasy, that raised Serafina's hackles. What was he really doing? Where was he when the man in the black cloak attacked? Did he work for him, or was he him? She looked suspiciously at Mr. Vanderbilt, too. She didn't like the way he was so tough on Braden, telling him what to do and not to do and how to feel. He had no idea what Braden had been through. He didn't listen any better than her pa, and he seemed far too quick to accept Mr. Crankshod's story that it had been bandits. Braden had said that his aunt and uncle had secretly sent him away for the night. So few people would have known he was going to be on the road at that time. And he had said that his uncle trusted Mr. Crankshod. Were they working together? She tried to think it through. Was it really possible that Mr. Vanderbilt was the man in the black cloak? Did he have some terrible need to swallow up all the children at Biltmore? After the men cleared the second tree from the road, those who weren't continuing on to search for Nolan climbed back into the carriages. The coachman began the intricate task of turning all the carriages around in the tight quarters of the narrow road so that they could head back to Biltmore Estate.
"I want you to ride with me in my carriage, Braden," Mr. Vanderbilt said. "Mr. Crankshod will drive us."
"Yes, sir," Braden said. "I understand, but we need to bring my horses home."
His horses had been harnessed, but there wasn't a coachman to drive them.
"I'll take care of it," Mr. Thorne volunteered.
He walked over to the horses, patted their heads gently as they nuzzled him, then climbed up into the empty driver's seat and gathered the reins. Serafina saw Braden's smile, relieved that Mr. Thorne was willing to help. But something struck her as a bit odd. Many gentlemen were accomplished riders, but few had any experience with driving a carriage, which was a servant's job. Mr. Bendel, who was riding his thoroughbred, came up alongside Mr. Thorne.
"Well, there you go, Thorne. You've got a fallback position if you ever lose your fortune."
"I have to get a fortune before I can lose it," Mr. Thorne said humbly.
The two gentlemen laughed with each other, but then Mr. Bendel became more serious, tipped his hat to Mr. Thorne and Mr. Vanderbilt, and joined a search party of half a dozen riders that was heading out to look for Nolan.
"Don't wait on supper for me,"
Mr. Bendel called back to his friends as he rode off with the other horsemen. Soon the carriages were all moving and heading down the road toward home. Serafina wanted desperately to go with them, but she knew she couldn't. She remained hidden in the bushes. She had to suppress a sense of panic that she was being left behind, that she'd never be able to find her way through the forest back to Biltmore. And she missed Braden's company already. As she watched the carriages recede into the distance, she thought, "Goodbye, my friend," and she hoped he was thinking the same. But even as the carriages disappeared, she felt a tingling sensation course through her limbs. She should have been frightened to be in the forest alone. All her life she'd been told to stay away from it. But now, here she was. Far from Biltmore, alone in the trees. And she had an idea. She was downright keen on it.
She just hoped that it wasn't going to get her lost or killed.
As she stepped onto the empty road and looked down the length of it, she had a weird and foreign feeling from being so far away from her pa and Biltmore and all the commotion there. She half expected to burst into tears, go running after the carriages and wail, "Wait! Wait! You forgot about me!" But she didn't, and she felt rather grown up about it. The sun was well up now and casting a lovely warm light on the trees. Birds were singing. There was a gentle breeze. Things weren't so bad in the forest. But then she looked down the long road winding through the trees and remembered that she was 11 miles from home. "I'll try to be home for dinner, Pa," she said, with a pang of uncertainty in her stomach. And she started walking. But she wasn't exactly heading for home. Not directly. The man in the black cloak had seemed to know the forest very well, and she remembered the tales of folk going missing. She had a creeping suspicion that the man in the black cloak might be in some way connected to the abandoned village that she'd heard tell about. She had decided she was going to find the old village and see if it gave her any clues. Why would all the people in a town abandon their homes and leave? There was a part of her, too, that was anxious to delve into the shadows of the forest, to see this mysterious world. It drew her. Not just because she'd been forbidden by her pa to come here, but by the thorny truth of her pa's own account. She'd been born here. She decided to walk on down the road a spell and see what she could see. Perhaps there would be an old sign pointing to the abandoned village. Or perhaps she'd meet someone along the road who might be able to tell her how to get there. One way or another, it seemed like it would be pretty easy to find an entire town. As she walked, her mind kept drifting back to her pa. She wished she could get a message to him. He'd be worried sick about her, especially with the horrible tales of disappearing children. She wondered if he ever got the dynamo working. It created the one thing that everyone other than her needed so desperately at night. Light. Who in the world would purposely damage an electric generator? And who would even know how to do something like that? Her pa was the only man on the estate who knew how it worked. Him, and maybe George Vanderbilt, if he referred to one of the books in his library. She thought that it was interesting how just about everyone had a special talent or skill, something they were naturally drawn to and good at, and then they worked years to master it. Nobody knew how to do everything. It wasn't possible. There wasn't enough time in the night. But everyone knew something. And everyone was a little different. Some people did one thing. Others did another. It made her think that maybe God intended for them to all fit together, like a puzzle made whole. It still stunned her when she tried to imagine her big, trained mechanic pa carrying a newborn baby out of the forest and taking care of her all those years. It had never occurred to her until now that she belonged anywhere but in the basement with her father. But now her mind ran wild with questions and ideas. She was anxious to get home, but walking down that road, she felt a little exhilarated that she was free and on her own. She could go in any direction she chose. She walked for an hour without seeing a soul. Nothing but blue jays and chickadees twitching about her, a few squirrels chattering away at her, and a mink dashing across the road in front of her like his life depended on it. She wasn't even sure she was still heading in the right direction anymore, but she figured she couldn't go wrong if she stayed on the road.
Then she came to a